Hello and welcome to Call of the Outdoors, the Pennsylvania Game Commission's podcast. You know, there's a whole lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes here in the agency, and today's podcast is really going to get down and dirty when we talk about prescribed fire. And with us today will be Dr. Scott Baer. He's the chief land manager in the land management division. We're actually in the wildlife habitat management division here in Harrisburg. And also Mr. Steve Ferrari from the Southeast region. He's a land management supervisor. We're going to go through everything that happens here at the agency when it comes to prescribed fire, creating that awesome habitat on our game land system. For Pennsylvania hunters and conservationists, our roots run deep. The episodes we bring to you on the Pennsylvania Game Commission's podcast, Call of the Outdoors, will take a deep dive into exposing the incredible work being done by agency staff and partners, including statewide habitat projects, the science behind wildlife management, and what drives agency decisions. The Pennsylvania Game Commission's mission is twofold: to manage and protect wildlife and their habitats for not only current but future generations, and to promote hunting and trapping in the Keystone State. Hey, a few things we wanted to let you know. The application period for the 37th Pennsylvania State Game Warden Cadet class closes on March 7th. New to this year on the requirements is a high school diploma or a GED certification. For more information, check out our website at pgc.pa.gov, or you can email us directly at pgccareers@pa.gov. The Pennsylvania Game Commission is also currently accepting applications for a variety of positions. You can explore career opportunities in forestry, wildlife biology, habitat management, and many more. Check us out on our website at pgc.pa.gov. Well, what a day we have. Daylight hours are getting longer. The birds are starting to sing. Spring's on its way. And we're here to talk with two fine gentlemen from the Pennsylvania Game Commission. And really, two folks that make a lot of things happen in the ground. Today we're going to talk about prescribed fire, and with us we have Steve Ferrari and Dr. Scott Baer. We call him Scotty Baer around the office, but I don't know if he likes that too much. But
I'll take it.
Yeah.
I've been called worse.
We all have. But Steve, just tell us a little bit about, you know, your career here at PGC. I mean, even though you're only 22, you've been here a long time.
Yeah, right. I wish I was still 22, but no, all good. Yeah, so started out as a forestry intern for 2 summers while I was in college. Then I started full-time with the agency in August of 2010 on our deer trapping crew for a couple months. Then I was a GIS specialist, so that's our big mapping and database management system we use to track all of our stuff in the Game Commission. Did that in the Southeast region for a couple years. Went up to Harrisburg, worked in our habitat division for a little bit. And then my passion's always been in habitat management. So at the time, in order to become a land manager, I'd go through our law enforcement training academy. So went through our Ross Leffler School of Conservation, became a game warden for a little bit. And then I was a land manager for a couple years. And now I'm the land management supervisor for the Southeast region. So it's been a good ride so far. Looking forward to the rest of it.
Okay, and that was cool because of the progression. I mean, you started.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's like the American dream, really. I mean, yeah. I know that's been your passion for a long time.
Absolutely.
And every day here is a challenge. And you know, Scott, I know you've been with us before, but just go ahead and hit on where you've been, and because you've been all over the place.
I have, and I won't bore you with the details, but most recently, I've been with the agency for about 5 years now as the chief land manager.
You and I are on about the same.
Yeah, you and I started right around the same time, I think a month apart.
Yeah, awesome.
I'm coming from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I was in the Division of Fire Management in the Southwest region. So my zone was Arizona, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Texas, and managed a decision support team for wildfire management. Since we're talking about fire today, I was first red carded in 1993.
Well, just for what is red card? Just for
it basically means that you're entering into the fire world. You're now in that entry level qualification to go on either prescribed fire or wildfires, and we'll talk about that difference a lot today. So yeah, I've been involved with fire for over 30 years now,
and that's a lot of times when folks look at the Game Commission, they don't realize how entrenched we are with professionals at what they do, and in every scope of the aspect of wildlife management and habitat management. I wanted to say something to you too, Steve, because you know this word when you think, I think of a couple words in our, that we use every day, that folks out there use every day. And one of them is habitat. And if you would, and I think we probably had you before, define habitat in your, just in your mind, because it can mean a lot of different things.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people, when they define habitat, they go to that triangle of, you know, space and food, resources, cover, everything like that. And that's pretty much the simplistic way to describe it. You know, what are the needs of the various wildlife species out there? That's habitat. It's different for different wildlife species, but that's pretty much the basics. You know, what are those requirements that different wildlife species need on the landscape? And those, that's habitat.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, including us.
Including us.
We have to have habitat. And, and when you relate it, that kind of thing, even when you, if you, if you're, I tell this to folks all the time, you know, even in my past life, like habitat is like our house, and we go to the grocery store or grow our garden or have venison in the freezer for food. And obviously we need water, and it's the same thing on the landscape. And, you know, that's where you guys and what you do is so crucial. And today we're going to talk about fire, because it's really misunderstood out there. And
yes, it is.
I'll throw it to you. And, you know, what is prescribed? Prescribed or prescribed? Because I hear, I mean, it's PRE, but how do you say it?
Yeah, prescribed fire.
There you go.
You know, that's maybe, well, maybe that's like a northern, maybe that's a northern versus a southern thing.
It's a prescription when you go to the drugstore to get your, you know, your doctor fills it. So it's,
That word prescription is really important.
It is. So, and I think that's, you know, prescribed fire, just to really simplify it, is it's, you know, it's a planned use of fire with safety kind of being the primary driver of things. We interchange prescribed fire with controlled burn, you know, having that controlled thing. But prescription is right there with it. You know, and that prescription, really the meat of that prescription, is in what we call a burn plan. So each one of our prescribed fires is required to have a burn plan, you know, 20 plus page document, you know, has specifics in there about, you know, what kind of weather parameters can we burn under? What sort of staff do we need? How many fire engines do we need on a burn? You know, it goes down all through that, smoke management, you know, you name it, where secondary control lines are, you know, where are the lines of the burn unit are. We don't need to dive too deep on that, but it's a big, long prescription of, you know, when we can implement these burns, how we can implement these burns, and kind of those objectives of using fire.
And burning's been, like, I know I've hunted down south a lot in my life, and, you know, down there it's a very common practice. And, you know, one ranch manager or whatever will go out there and take a torch, and he'll do whatever he needs to do. But, like, what we're doing is 100% science. And why do we burn? Let's just talk about that. Why? A lot of folks don't realize, why would you just light a match? But what is the reason?
So maybe it would be helpful to even back up a step from that and talk about this difference between wildfires and prescribed fire. Because I think a lot of folks, when they hear just the word fire, it evokes an emotion, and a lot of that is tied to what they're seeing on the television from the big crown fires out in California or in Australia or in Europe. Here in the Appalachians, we have prescribed fire. Well, let me back up and even say that wildfires are an important part of this landscape. We have a lot of fire-adapted ecosystems here in the Appalachians, and we'll talk a little bit about that in the three communities that we focus on for fire. You know, whether it be lightning strikes, whether it be thousands of years of Native American burning, which the Native Americans did primarily for berry production, whether it be blueberries or huckleberries or browse that could be developed from, you know, what comes after the burn, you bring the wildlife in. It was a tool that was used to not only bring the wildlife in, but provide a food source for wildlife. So for thousands of years, Native Americans have used fire, and fire has occurred naturally from lightning strikes. And then, of course, during the turn of the century, you had a lot of fires that were started from locomotives and throwing sparks and that kind of thing. So we have highly adapted communities in the Appalachians here that are that need to burn. But the important thing is that these fires that we have in Pennsylvania, are you know, when we talk about prescribed fire, we are talking about that prescription. We are using fires as one management tool in our toolbox, in our suite of management options. Fire is used to restore and renew and regenerate the health and maintain the health of those different systems. So it's really important for people to understand the difference between wildfire and it's not those uncontrolled burns that you see out in California. In Pennsylvania, our prescribed fires are often very low in intensity. Sometimes you're just burning the leaflet, or sometimes your fire is only a couple inches tall. And then people have this vision of what fire is in Pennsylvania, and they need to understand that that's what we're talking about.
When you just taking it down a little, if you go down there, out there in the leaves, and they're, you know, 6-8 inches, and you scratch it and you see a little oak tree that's growing down there.
That's right.
I mean, how long has that oak tree been growing under that leaf litter?
Well, that's a great point. So oak systems are one of the three systems where we do fire, and you have to understand a little bit of oak ecology and understand that little oak seedling, that acorn, spent a few years sending down its root system, growing that root system. And so you can burn that leaf litter, and that oak will be just fine. So oak forest management is one of the reasons that we use prescribed fire, because the oaks really benefit from right. that tool.
But I know I walked with Dave Mitchell a couple years ago at my place, and he showed me an oak tree that was like this big, and the deer had eaten. He goes, that tree's probably 10 years old, and it was sticking out of the ground that far. You know, I never knew that. I mean, you think that was like the first year, and then until you dig in deeper, and, you know, just one of the many benefits of prescribed fire. But if Steve, if you would, just a little bit of the short history, or either one of you, whoever wants to take this, sure. of here at the Game Commission, a little bit of our burn history, where we started, you know, how many acres roughly do we do a year, and yep. where technology has led us today?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, we've been burning, staff in our agency has been burning for decades, you know, but a lot of that burning in the past was small, you mm-hmm. know, maybe a couple acre fields here or there, very, very low numbers statewide. 2009, there was some legislation passed that really enabled us to start burning. In 2010 and 11, we really stood up our prescribed fire program in our agency, and it was beautiful. I mean, you had the grassroots effort of people in the regions on the ground, you know, really getting engaged and excited about fire. And you had the support from, you know, Harrisburg and supervisors up top. And it was just a great, you know, symbiotic program that really started up here. But, you know, we on average now burn about 10 to 15,000 acres a year. Weather's our biggest limiting factor. You know, we get, you know, roughly 20-ish burn days a year that we're really...
It takes the perfect day,
takes
right?
the perfect yeah. day, That's yeah, right. those weather variables. You know, being in the northeast part of the country, you know, our primary window's in that springtime, just because that's when we get the magical weather conditions that fit. You start getting in the summer, start getting more humidity. It's tough to really get fire to get on the ground there. So, yeah, our prescribed burn program has been growing since about 2011. Currently, we have 280 people that are certified to be on our burn crew. Of those 280, about 30 are burn bosses. So the burn boss is somebody who oversees that burn. So really, you know, it's a really professional program. All those staff have to go through a pretty regimented training process. There's different, as you move up through the ranks of prescribed fire, there's different what we call task books. So people have to basically prove on paper that they have the training and experience to move up that ladder as you gain more responsibility on a fire.
Yeah, we got to witness, Scott, I have it on videotape actually, when you had at the office when you were practicing crawling in your, that safety tent or whatever, it looked like a cocoon kind of.
Yeah, that's what we call a fire shelter. We have to do that every year.
In split second.
And, you know, there is not only the task books that Steve was talking about, but every year we have to do an annual refresher. We have to take classes every year to maintain that current certification. So there's a lot that goes into being a member of the prescribed fire crew.
Yeah, it's just, you just can't put on a yellow suit and go out there and do it.
Yeah, that is correct.
Because, I mean, mm-hmm. there's a lot of safety and risks and all that. Let's talk about prescription and yeah. prescribed. And we hear that word a lot around the office, and maybe not out, you know, outside, but, you know, we talked briefly about it earlier, but what is a prescription?
Like, right. So it depends on where you're having that, where you're planning that prescribed fire. There's a lot that goes into it. So it can be everything from you have thresholds in relative humidity, like you're only going to be able to burn if your RH is between these factors, same with air temperature, same with wind direction. Wind direction is a really important part of conducting a safe prescribed fire operation, because we want to be able to manage our smoke. Smoke management is really important, because there's no doubt that when you are burning the forest, you're going to put up a smoke column. You don't want that smoke column to go down into a community of people, especially if somebody in that community has asthma or respiratory distress. So you want to avoid those kinds of things. You don't want to put your smoke column down over a highway. So there are things like that, and we are factoring in all of that. That all gets written into the prescription, and all that stuff is articulated there, and you have to follow that. As soon as you go out of your prescription, you know, you don't want to go out of your prescription.
Understood. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to fathom, because I've been to the ARs too. I've been on a fire and watched the after action, you know, and it's pretty amazing. And the coolest thing to me, from an outsider not having a clue what's going on, is the passion that the folks, the land management teams have to put habitat on the ground.
That's right.
And you know, you kind of hit on earlier, and like when you do a burn, and I'm just going to go for the negatives that we hear, because obviously on social media, you know, you're like, you guys are burning up turkey nests and this and that. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it happens. There's no doubt about it. But you know, our mission is to manage wildlife and their habitats for current and future. And fire is something that really you need a vision to look at the future for what the benefits of it are.
Right. So I'll tell you that
I might have been getting ahead of myself.
Not at all. Let's tackle this one head on, because this is a really important one. And like you said, it's one that we get questions about a lot, because, you know, understanding from the public's perspective, there does seem to be this overlap between turkey nesting season and when we're doing our prescribed fire. As Steve had mentioned, we're really limited on the number of days we can burn. Now, let's talk about impacts to wildlife in general, but focused on turkey. This is something that we take very seriously. And whether we're having conversations with our own turkey biologist, Mary Jo, or whether we look at decades of research, thinking about it in two levels, fire impacts at the population level or fire impacts to the individual nest. The science is very clear. There is a very small negative impact. In fact, if you look at some of the research, whether you know, you look at Dr. Craig Harper's work or Dr. Marcus Lashley's work out of University of Florida, or Dr. Michael Chamberlain's work out of University of Georgia, who what I would encourage folks to do is go to Google Scholar and type in those folks' name and with the word wild turkey research, and you'll see Gregory Wann, his last name is Wann, published a really good journal article in 2020 in the Journal of Forest Ecology and Management, where he conducted a meta-analysis, a synthesis of decades of research, over 90 different studies that were conducted, fire effects on turkeys. And the science was very clear. Out of all those studies, you have very minimal negative effects and very significant positive impacts, both at the population level and at the nest level. In Gregory's study, or maybe it was Eric Kilgade's study, it was 3% impact. So out of the 100 nests that they found, only 3% of those nests were being negatively impacted by fire. And then he actually has some photographs of a nest that was impacted by fire. And you can see one of the eggs was even a little bit darkened from the fire. That nest hatched. And I think the survivorship of that particular nest that even had fire move over it, 8 out of 10 of those eggs hatched.
I think it's important when we talk about this too, to just put this in perspective of scale.
Yeah,
so, you know,
that's
if you look at our state game land system where we focus fire on, you know, we have 1.6 million acres roughly of state game lands. Of that, right now in our mapping system, you know, we have roughly 218,000 acres that are in burn units right now. And like I said earlier, we only burn 10 to 15,000 acres per year. So
it's less than 1%.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, when you're looking at scale, sure. Is there the potential to negatively impact a nest or two here or there? Absolutely. You know, guaranteed. Like it could definitely happen. But when you're looking at that larger landscape, you know, we are not burning across enough acreage to have population level negative impacts, you know, and two, you know, Scotty mentioned that some of those nests even hatched that were affected. Some of these birds, depending on the time of the year, would even do a renesting attempt.
Right. That's the beauty about turkeys.
And not just turkeys, but all, you know, all avian species that are ground nesting birds, you know, even, you know, our warblers and other stuff, you know, they, if they have a disturbance event, be it fire or predation or whatever, a lot of these critters try to make a secondary nesting attempt.
And if I can jump in here, you know, let's keep in mind that poults, even 24 hours after they're hatched, they're incredibly mobile. So even a day after the hatch, if you had a fire move through, the poults can move out of that area. And we should talk a little bit about how we actually conduct the burn so that folks understand that we're not ringing the fire and trapping all wildlife in there. We do it in a way, in a systematic way, that allows wildlife to escape. So we can circle back to that. But I do want to mention that we even have a lot of our staff have observations of, they'll conduct a prescribed fire. And even while that burn unit is still smoldering and smoking, they'll see turkey flocks and poults come back into the, come back into that burn unit, because it's really easy for them to find the insects to bug around.
I, you know, especially in the southern part of the country, if there's fire and you don't have any clue where to go hunting and you see some smoke in the air where they're doing, I mean, gobblers love it. I mean, because the turkeys are there.
Yeah.
I don't know if they eat the burn bugs, or I have no clue, but like, I've seen them with their feet so black and soot. I mean, they are attracted to those areas.
Yeah.
For sure.
No, yep. You'll see a lot of live insects.
And the cool thing, when you think about, fast forward it to next year after a burn goes through, and let's say the hen did have a nest in that, and this is totally anecdotal, but just where my mind's going, you're creating better cover, better habitat, better areas for that hen to nest. So, you know, to stay away from predation.
And that's a lot of what the research shows too. They, you know, if you look at Gregory Wan's research or Michael Chamberlain's, you know, they'll say that don't burn 2 years after you've already burned an area, because once you burn, those 2 years after that burn are epic nesting cover. So as long as we're not revisiting those areas, you know, we will have very minimal impact on turkey populations.
And you know, when you look at habitat and what we do, what your bureau does, and you know, from an outsider looking in, like I remember my first year here riding with Dave Gustafson, and he's like, we're trying to recreate what Mother Nature does mm-hmm. out there to make better habitat. And really, fire is one of those. You look at the western side of the, in wildfires, I mean, that's important to those grass grazing animals out there.
That's right.
Without fire, sometimes food's tough to find for those animals out there. And that's, you know, when you look at it, we're not trying to be Mother Nature. We're trying to help Mother Nature leave it better than we found it.
Well, that's a really good point. So maybe now's a good chance, Steve, if I may, is a good time for us to talk about those three ecosystems where we do prescribe fire. So we had already talked about oak forests. We do prescribe fire in oak forests to maintain the health and resilience of those oak forest communities, because you're helping the oaks, but you're also, in other words, the oaks will survive, but the other species that are kind of competing for resources, for light, for nutrients, you'll kill those species of trees. So you're really helping the oaks when you do a prescribed fire. The other community that we do a lot of prescribed fire in are barrens communities. And there's a number of different barrens communities in Pennsylvania. A lot of them have a lot of rare, threatened, and endangered plant species, insect species. Again, these are your barrens communities, whether it be your pitch pine, scrub oak communities on game lands, 176 Scotia Barrens, or whether you're up in the Poconos and the Mesic Till Barrens. Prescribed fire is a really important part, an important tool to maintain the health of those
barrens.
They're a unique system.
What does that entail to the folks that are listening out there?
Well, I think if you have to encapsulate it, think of a real shrubby plant species called scrub oak.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of I don't know how would you describe scrub oak?
Shorter, you know, 6-8 foot tall on average.
Tough to walk through.
Produces acorns pretty early in life compared to a lot of the other oak trees mm-hmm. that most people are used to.
That's right.
Yep.
Right.
I wasn't trying to interrupt, but it's sometimes we get so ingrained. And like I'm thinking I know what you're talking about, but that kind of tells telltale what it is.
There's a really important part of Pennsylvania history when you think of scrub oak, especially pitch pine barrens, because pitch pine especially, well, maybe we don't need to talk about this now. I'm going to get too far into the weeds of pitch pine ecology.
But
well, pitch pine used to be an incredibly important tree species in the northern tier of Pennsylvania. During the Great Cut of the 1900s, you had a lot of removal of pitch pine. But then it was actually during World War II, they made ammunition boxes out of pitch pine. And then they removed like kind of the last remnant pitch pines that we had in northern Pennsylvania. And then you follow that up with white-tailed deer impacts. It's really changed our system. So to your earlier point, we're trying to get these ecosystems kind of back on track, because right now they're a little bit unhealthy. And we're bringing fire back in to get them to be healthy again.
And you said something just there a second ago, and a lot of folks, you know, we had a major campaign about it this past fall, and it's one of the issues that we face for habitat is making sure that our deer population is, you know, where it needs to be in a healthy deer herd where that's they're not right. destroying the habitat that's trying to regrow. You burn, exactly. put a fire through somewhere, and it really helps everything down there, and we have too many deer, it's status quo because it's not going to help.
Great point. Yeah. That's exactly
and,
right.
And that's sometimes when we look at deer hunting and we all want to see lots of deer when we go out there. And I get that 100%. I'm one of those. But if you can't sustain it and we can't have that habitat grow so when we're gone, it's better for our children and our grandchildren, we're not doing our job.
Yeah, for
sure. That's our goal.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, you touched on deer there. You know, sometimes, you know, our forestry activities and prescribed fire in a forest setting can be almost too much of a good thing. You know, it creates all that young succulent growth and it can attract deer. And if you have areas where deer numbers are just a little bit too high, like it can really, you know, negatively impact a lot of that vegetation we're hoping to grow and perpetuate into the future.
Yeah.
So let's just talk about the burns real quick. You know, we have over 1.5 million, yep. you know, closing in on 1.6, but you yep. know, that's a lot of land. I mean, when you think about it, we're the same size as the state of Delaware and state game lands, land that we have, that we're providing hunting and trapping opportunities, be able to, you know, work with the habitat, manage, you know, that's, but how do you figure out where these birds, I know you talked about the three different systems, but is that the only way that we look at it, those three different ecosystems? Well,
and I don't know if I ever mentioned the third one. Yeah, we forgot the last one. I'll just mention grasslands yep. are really important.
Yeah.
And the primary objective in grasslands, just to simplify for everybody, is keep fields. Like we're hitting, when we use fire in a grassland setting or a field setting, we're simply hitting the reset button to make sure succession doesn't take hold in that grassland, doesn't transition to a shrubland or a young forest, you know, eventually. So we're just, fire is our reset button in those fields.
Does it keep it healthier? Because I know like you go to Kansas.
Yep.
And I don't know anything. Like I've been to Kansas in turkey season and they're burning wheat fields like square miles.
Right.
And they light it on one end, and is it just for regrowth? Is that?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's multiple down in the weeds, no pun intended, objectives of burning fields, but, you know, it definitely keeps it healthier. You know, it mm-hmm. helps keep that balance of grasses and wildflowers or forbs, you know, in check. Keep, you know, because we don't want fields of just solid grass. Right. We don't want fields that are, you know, we want diversity in fields. Diversity of plants equals diversity of insects, which equals diversity of all kinds of species up the food web.
Right.
So that's the simplistic goals there.
You know, while we're on the subject of deer, which, you know, in our state, when you look at the keystone animal for wildlife anywhere in the country for wildlife, right. you know, conservation, white-tailed deer comes to mind. And, you know, when you talk about what burns do and, you know, let's just talk about browse and, you know, how much browse one whitetail needs and what these burns do to create that woody browse.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you look at a closed canopy forest, you know, if that forest isn't dropping mast or acorns, you know, and there's nothing in the understory, what's a deer going to eat? So, you know, in some of these systems, you know, fire coupled with some other forestry activities, you know, like say we come in there and we'll run a fire through something and there'll be, you know, 2-3 inch red maples, for example. Well, all that browse is out of the reach of a deer. So when we come in there, run a fire and top kill that 2-3 inch red maple diameter, 2-3 mm-hmm. inch, you know, it causes that plant to sprout from the base again. So it's bringing all that browse that's up high, puts it down to the ground in reach of where deer can get. So as a deer hunter, I kind of focus on hunting those areas. It's really good for numerous years post fire. So I mean, that's a simplistic way to kind of describe how fire creates more browse, aside from, you know, stimulating growth of plants out of the soil. But
so you say, as a deer hunter, let me ask you a deer hunting question.
I don't know if we want to go there.
Okay. I just want to make sure you've been practicing with your rifle.
It's all good. Hey, okay. If you're not missing deer, you're not hunting enough.
I won't go too far in depth, but when you miss something when I'm there, you usually don't live it down.
I figured. Yep. I was expecting it.
But that's a great thing right there. So we go into an area up north on a game lands.
Yep.
In second week of the season, in an area where there's a lot of habitat work going on, burns included. I mean, we get to an area that doesn't get a lot of pressure because it's tough to get to. And how many bucks we see that day?
It was a lot. It was a lot. I mean,
and there was none less that left with us.
There was none less that left with us.
But shots were fired.
Yep.
Not mine. But Steve about killed me getting down in this hole. It's the worst place I've ever been in my life.
Really?
Oh yeah. I think he did it on purpose. Yeah, so I told
him. What game land was this?
That's a secret spot. That's a secret spot. I can't tell you about that. We don't even know the number of it anymore. We lost it.
No, you got to go to where the deer are, and the deer are where the habitat is.
Yeah, so, and where people weren't, you know, and it was pretty incredible. And, you know, the second week of deer season, and I think we saw probably 15, 20 deer that
easily,
day.
Yeah. Easily, yep.
It was pretty awesome. So, you know, we talked about that, and let's talk about time of year. We hit on it a little bit earlier, but, I mean, it can happen multiple times a year, but we have a main, like you said, you know, 20-day window or something. But let's talk about why again, just to recap on that.
Sure. I mean, ideally we would burn as much as we could any day of the year. Right. It's just weather, especially in the Northeast, is kind of that limiting factor. So, like I said earlier, spring is kind of our primary window when we do a lot of our fire. So that late March, April into early May window, that's where we're doing a lot of our fire. Once again, especially in forested settings, you know, leaf canopy hasn't really grown out yet. Humidities are staying lower. We're just kind of timing things, you know, days since last rain. So obviously we can't burn snow, we can't burn water. So things need to dry out. And usually in the spring we get those conditions. In systems where we don't have a closed canopy in the summertime, sometimes we'll get little periods of lower humidities. We can get in there and burn in the middle of, you know, summer or later summer. And then things kind of pick back up in the fall, August, September timeframe for a lot of our burning. And same thing with fields. It applies to fields. It applies to the forest.
It's those times when the leaves aren't on the trees so that the sunlight can directly kind of heat up and dry out the forest floor. That's when we're able to burn. Mm-hmm. Like Steve said, March, April is really our sweet season, in May as well. We are burning every month out of the year. We've been able to conduct prescribed fire every month out of the year. But it's really that spring season that is when we're able to accomplish most acres. I will say we also are restricted. There are some federal restrictions on when we can't burn. So we have to mind those as well.
And those are usually related to, you know, species effects.
Exactly.
On wildlife species effects.
That's right.
Yep.
So like when you, and I'm sure it varies, but if you had an average of on the landscape of an area that you burn at one time, how big or small would that be?
I mentioned our GIS system, our spatial thing that, you know, keeps track of all of our units and how many units we have on the landscape. Our average burn unit, now this is across all plant community types, so grassland, forestland, our average burn unit is only 50 acres. Now, we do have some burn units that are upwards of pushing 3,000 acres, but it's important to realize when you get into those large units, fire effects across that unit aren't equal.
That's right.
So when you get into burning a 1,000-2,000 acre unit, say with a helicopter or drone, which we didn't really touch on yet, but
how do you touch on that?
You have to understand that, you know, fire isn't equally impacting that landscape. You have areas and hollows or drainages where it might be a little bit more damp, and fire isn't even burning across that entire landscape. So when people see us burning large acres, it's a mosaic of results in there. Some areas unburned, some areas moderately burned, some areas burned with a little higher intensity.
That's right. And I think that's really important for folks to realize that when you get into those larger units, there's a mosaic. It's interspersed different types of fire intensity across that acreage.
So it's a work of art. I mean,
it absolutely yeah. is. And every time, you know, it's similar to when you're doing forest management. Every time you touch that chainsaw to a tree, you're changing that forest for the next 100 years. Same with fire. Every time you drop down that drip torch, you could potentially be changing that landscape for many years. When we talk about the different types of fire, you know, we talked about the acreage sizes. I think it would be easier to break it into kind of three brackets. There's the acreages that we can accomplish with our hand ignitions. In other words, guys carrying around drip torches doing that work. And that takes us from about, you know, 5-10 acres up to about 300 acres. 300 acres that's a long day for guys, you know, carrying drip torches.
It's half a square mile when you look at it, you know.
That's right.
It's a lot.
And when you think about it on the top end, when we bring in a helicopter to do that aerial ignition, that again, you're not talking about a blanket of fire. You're talking about interspersed mosaic of fire. That's, you know, 800, 1,000 acres or greater is when you would want to bring in the aircraft. The nice thing with this more recent technology are the drones. And we do have some prescribed fire drones that we do use here in the Game Commission. And that fits into that neat little sweet spot in between that 300 acres and 800,000 acres at the top end. We can bring a drone in to accomplish burning on those units.
And talk about that, because I know I've watched you demonstrate it, how that works.
Yep. Yeah. So a lot of people, when we first say we're using a drone with prescribed fire, they think of this like flamethrower hanging off the bottom. Yeah, no, totally not that. Same thing with the helicopter. Both of the helicopter and the drone, they have a specialized device where they drop these small little spheres about the size of a ping pong ball to the ground. There's a powder substance in there called potassium permanganate, but it gets injected with glycol, antifreeze, same thing that runs in the radiator of your car. And usually about 30 to 45 seconds, that sphere will hit the ground and a little chemical reaction starts and you get a little 3-inch flame. And basically, you know, we'll use that drone to kind of fly and grid out the entire unit. And we'll just start a bunch of these really small fires. And then those small fires just converge in a nice controlled manner into each other. And once fire meets fire, pretty much goes out. Once the fuel's consumed, it's done. So it's a really awesome technology. It's really... it's increased our safety. We don't have to put people through prescribed fire units anymore carrying drip torches. We keep them out of that terrain. We keep them, you know, they don't have to walk through all those tripping hazards. It's also increased our efficiency, you know, where like Scotty mentioned, you know, a 300 acre unit may take a full day to burn out. You know, we can light off, you know, 100 acres with a drone in 20 minutes. So it's a lot more efficient.
Yeah. And talk about, let's take a 100 acre burn.
Yep.
Let's say we're doing it tomorrow. Talk about, you know, real quick, the process, how many people are involved in like start to finish and when you leave.
Yep. So we'll talk about the process real quick. So just to give people a mental picture. So we'll just talk a square box really quick. So typically we'll start a fire, you know, on the downwind side. So, you know, imagine walking into the wind, with the wind in your face. You know, we don't want to start a fire on the upwind side where wind would be at your back. You know, it would just push you right through the unit. So we start fire with the wind in the fire's face.
Maybe nice. Talk about the test fire too.
Sure. Yeah. Test fire. So that's when we're starting the burn. So we start with a small fire in say the corner. And that usually most of our fire units are surrounded by what we call a fire break. So it's an area devoid of any fuels. You know, typically, you know, down to bare mineral soil. Sometimes we'll use administrative gravel roads. Just, you know, things that aren't receptive to fire. And
would you ever use like a disc or anything like that?
Sure. Yeah. Freshen them up. Yeah. Absolutely. We run a disc over it, over like a vegetative surface to just make sure that bare mineral soil's there. That's not going to carry fire. So yeah, we'll start that test fire, in that area. And then if everything's going good, our fire behaviors aren't out of control. We're seeing that, you know, flame lengths we're looking for about, you know, maybe a foot, 2 foot tops. Usually it's even lower than that. Then we'll just keep progressing and we'll start
can
off
I,
those fire breaks.
Can I jump
breaks.
In here too sure. real quick and say that while that's happening, like right before test fire, during test fire, you have somebody on the fire that's actually slinging a weather so that you're you know, taking those readings of relative humidity, wind speed, wind direction, air temperature, all that kind of stuff to make sure that you're still within that prescription. Sorry, yep. I just wanted to
make folks aware. So typically our fire breaks are roughly, you know, 6 feet wide. So what we'll do is we'll start carrying fire along those fire breaks and allowing fire to what we call back into the unit. So fire's backing slowly into the unit, kind of building out the width of that fire break, building in that safety factor. You know, enforcing those fire breaks.
And what can happen is, like Steve was saying, is, you know, let's say squad A is going in this direction, squad B is going in that direction. You know, one squad could have, you know, 10 folks or 20 folks. It could have, you know, three fire engines and several UTVs with all fitted with water tanks and hoses and all that kind of stuff. And then a whole bunch of firefighters go in that direction. Whole bunch of firefighters go in that direction. And then you could have an interior ignition crew of several firefighters that are, you know, dragging that torch.
Yeah, so once those perimeters, we have more black established off those perimeters and our perimeters are secure, that's when we start doing the internal ignition. So that's when we'll get the drone up in the air, grid out a section of it, or if it's a smaller unit, that's when we'll send our folks through the middle of it with drip torches and burn out the center of it. So very simplistic kind of description of it, but that's the gist. Right.
But if you can visualize that, what's happening is fire is slowly creeping around the unit. Meanwhile, the interior igniters are moving fire, you know, from that side in towards the center. So I think I just want to mention that because the wildlife have the ability to escape. They can, you know, the birds can fly, the mammals can run, the snakes can duck down in rock crevices and hide. That the way we actually conduct the fire is, you know, allows wildlife to move out of that system. And, you know, like Steve had mentioned, it's that mosaic. You're not always getting, a whole area burned. There's often a lot of areas that are unburned, and that's perfectly fine for us. That's actually what preferred, that we like to see that. It's also really important to mention that, you know, the person interior in that unit carrying that drip torch has a lot of ability to finesse what they're putting, where they're putting the fire and how they want that fire to move through the forest floor or field or barrens community when they put that fire down. So if there's somebody's tree stand in the middle of that unit, or we've had people's camera traps or, you know, their wildlife cameras out there, we will make a point of, you know, applying the fire in such a way that it protects those tree stands and cameras and other Absolutely. Things that we
Even
find out on game lands.
Should be down before fire season.
Depends. Depends, unless we're burning the fall.
I got
Yeah, fall, good point, right. But now might be a good time to talk about maybe how people, we can notify people or people Absolutely. Get more information about fires.
Yeah,
so,
great.
You know, our website is loaded with information on prescribed fire. So I think we'll have some links in the podcast description here that people can hit up to get more information. But, you know, on our website, there's also a web map, so an interactive map that people can see where all of our planned units are for that given year. And as we get closer to those burn days, what we call when a burn becomes imminent, so we're looking at weather, it's looking like, hey, two days out, we're going to probably be targeting this unit. You know, that burn unit kind of gets flagged that, hey, we're going to be burning this unit coming up. So that web map is constantly updated. To show where we're going to be burning.
And it's a really important resource for folks to know about.
And staff on the ground, we actually post around the perimeter of a burn unit that, hey, this unit's going to be burned. So if there's anybody recreating out on the game lands, hunters, you know, they know that, hey, this could be burned. Another thing we're piloting in certain part of the state right now is an email and text notification system that people can sign up for.
That's in your region, Southeast.
Southeast right now, you know, one of our more populated regions. So we're piloting it right now, hoping to go statewide with it. But people can basically sign up to get text alerts for whatever counties they select in the state. So when we're getting ready to burn, you know, usually a day before, we'll send out a notification and say, hey, you know, burn's going to be happening on XYZ game lands tomorrow. So really have a lot of ways that people can get more information and know when and where we're burning.
And I know, you know, we're doing some studies and conducting some studies with Fish and Boat on burns and you know, talk about that and some of our partners that you guys work with on a, you know, regular basis.
Sure. Well, so as far as partners in the fire world, there's maybe two different types of partners that we work a lot with. First is the partnerships in conducting the prescribed fire. So that's actually an important part of our history of our fire program here at the Game Commission. You know, starting, like Steve said, around that 2009 area when House Bill 262 was passed, which became Act 17, which was our prescribed fire legislation, which kind of opened the door for us to do more prescribed fire, which we didn't really talk about today, but we probably should. We're kind of in our infancy of our fire program, but we partnered with the Nature Conservancy. Shout out to Pat McElhenney and Jenny Case and George Gress and all the folks at TNC who really helped Ben Jones, John Wakefield here at our agency really blossom our fire program. So there are partnerships there also with, you know, the feds, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Allegheny National Forest with the Forest Service. And I want to give it a really important shout out to our sister agency at DCNR, Mike Kern, the Bureau of Forestry, Todd Breininger, Matt Reed, those folks. They've been a really important part. While they're focused on, and they come from the perspective of wildfire suppression, we've been able to really strike an important balance with them as partners, where they also do some prescribed fire, and we partner a lot with them. And also DCNR State Parks, where we have a really important partnership, conducting a lot of prescribed fire on state park lands. So there's a lot of partnerships on that end. And then, of course, there's the fire science, because as I had mentioned before, we take fire and its impacts on wildlife very seriously. Our mission is, you know, to try to maintain and enhance the health and the habitats for Pennsylvania's wildlife, right? So that's what we're focused on. So we don't want to do something that is causing a negative impact on the wildlife out there. So yes, we are involved. Right now we have a study going on with Fish and Boat Commission where we're looking at an East Stroudsburg University, looking at fire impacts on timber rattlesnakes and box turtles. Because box turtles are one of those species, you know, I talked about wildlife being able to get out of an area pretty quick. Box turtles are one of those species that we, you know, have some concerns that they might not be able to escape.
Because they're known to be fast.
Right. Exactly. So we want to try to figure out how we can improve the habitat for those species, but not negatively impact them. So we take the approach to the science of fire very seriously.
There's no doubt. It's just amazing to hear all this stuff. And guys, I mean, it's been awesome, and we need to do this again and yep. just continue to spread this message for all the good work. You got something else to
one,
say?
One thing we got to hit on, and we talked about this, is the Prescribed Fire Council and right. the new Certified Prescribed Burn Manager Program.
Yeah, so maybe
you caught me on that. Sorry,
it's all good. We got you.
Well, so yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because it is a really important newly emerging program that's really at its infancy. And in fact, while we've been working on it behind the scenes for a few years, what we're talking about is the Certified Prescribed Burn Manager Program, the CPBM. If right now it's being housed by the Pennsylvania Prescribed Fire Council. It will then, over the next couple years, transition to a DCNR program. But this is the CPBM program is a mechanism that's going to allow natural resource professionals, think of a consulting forester or an environmental consultant, who can achieve a burn boss title that is not NWCG certified. So it's not going to take them years to get that kind of qualification, but it could take them, you know, a much shortened amount of time, and then they can start conducting prescribed fire on private lands. So there's going to be a really interesting thing developing here over the next couple of years.
So that's a stay tuned too.
Well, it is, but I will say that the fire council just advertised it and put it onto their webpage. We're actually working with Tall Timbers down in Florida to develop the course, the workshop, the program, but at least folks can start getting information if they go to the Pennsylvania Prescribed Fire Council's webpage, and they'll see the links to the CPBM program. And of course we can put a link here on your page as well.
You said Tall Timbers, and that, you mm-hmm. know, actually, obviously Tall Timbers is involved in our new, you know, our quail restoration project.
That's right.
Yep. I actually, when we talk about burns, I used to turkey hunt on a plantation that was involved in Tall Timbers. And that's where I really first saw burns, you know, for the quail. And it's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
You know, those plantation managers down there, they burn all the time. Mm-hmm. And that was where my experience with turkeys came from. So, you know, that's different different types of woods down there. I mean, obviously big pines, but like the habitat that they create is pretty amazing.
Well, I'm glad you're talking about the quail project at Letterkenny, because there was a lot of work from John Wakefield, our former fire program manager, a lot of work with our fire staff to do prescribed fire at Letterkenny to kind of set the stage for that quail reintroduction. So yeah, fire is an important part of that story too.
Absolutely. And it's an important part of a lot of our stories, as is all the work you guys do. And my hat's off to you for, you know, you wildlife and habitat is in your mind every day, even when we're off the clock. I mean, that's what you guys think about. And you're definitely leaving our state, our agency in a better place. But thank you, gentlemen, for joining us. We'll have to do this again. And I know, Scotty, you wanted to take us out of here with a special message.
I do have a special message. You know, like Steve had mentioned, we have 280 some odd folks that are part of our fire program. We only have one person that is our fire program manager. So there's only one person in this agency where their full-time job is prescribed fire. Everybody else is taking it on as kind of an additional task, an additional duty as part of their job. So I want to kind of give two levels of a shout out. The first is to thank all of our burn bosses and our fire leadership, those folks that really step up to make this program successful. But more importantly, I do want to spend just a minute to acknowledge and pay tribute and kind of dedicate this podcast to one of our own, Chuck Wiseman, who tragically died last weekend. He was dedicated. He was 73 years old and still working for this agency. If that isn't passion and love for not only this agency, but for you know, dedicating his life to Pennsylvania's wildlife, I don't know what to say. But Chuck was a really important, valuable member of our prescribed fire program and our prescribed fire family. So just wanted to give Chuck and his family a shout out and thank him for his dedication. And so
absolutely,
here's to Chuck.
And you know, yeah, absolutely. And you know, he was on the job. He was out there doing another, you know,
doing what he loved to do.
He was trapping turkeys for the research project. And I hear you on that one. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And with that, we're going to take it out of here. Thank you, gentlemen.
Yep, thank you. This has been great. I have to do it again. You.